Hello and welcome to our program. I'm Jim Martinez, and I'll be your host for the 2008 Turning Sight into Sound Christmas Special. This year's selection of stories are read by some of your favorite volunteers here at Turning Sight into Sound, and are taken from a book titled A Cup of Comfort for Christmas. Stories that celebrate the warmth, joy, and wonder of the holiday. Edited by Colleen Sell. Published by Adams Media. You'll not only hear these wonderful stories, but you'll also hear the history of Christmas trees, the mistletoe, and the history of Santa Claus. We'll introduce our readers as we go along. Many Christians have a problem with including Santa Claus in their Christmas celebrations. Some see the jolly old elf as a competitor to Jesus. Yet Santa, unlike traditions such as Christmas trees, holly, and mistletoe, is at least partially based on Christian principles and the example of Christian men. There is nothing theological about Santa, but there is a great deal that makes him the perfect secular companion for the holy day, when we stop and recognize Christ's birth. Santa Claus's roots can be traced back to St. Nicholas of Bari. The son of wealthy parents, Nicholas was born in the 4th century in the town of Patara, Lycia, now part of Turkey. Legend records that when his parents died, the young man took all the family's money and distributed it to the needy in his hometown. He then accepted the call to full-time Christian service, becoming a monk when he was only 17, and shortly thereafter, a priest. The few historical records from the time indicate that he was chosen to fill the position of Archbishop of Myra while he was still in his early 20s. Nicholas must have been a remarkable man, wise beyond his years, and exhibiting a maturity that few gain until they are well past 40. Because of his great wisdom and sensitivity, many groups throughout history have claimed Nicholas as their patron saint. Children, orphans, sailors, and even thieves look to this compassionate saint for guidance and protection. Entire countries, including Russia and Greece, also adopted him. Thus, he is seemingly a saint for all people in all ages. The date of Nicholas's death, December 6, probably in the late 340s or 350s, was one of the great sadness for the people of ancient Asia Minor. But he was not forgotten. On every anniversary of his passing, his life was commemorated with an annual feast. On St. Nicholas's Eve, youngsters would set out food for Nicholas and straw for his donkey. The next morning, obedient children awoke to find their gifts replaced with sweets and toys. St. Nicholas's Day is still observed in many countries. And on this day, gifts are exchanged in honor of the spirit of faith, hope, and charity that he embodied. After the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, the veneration of Catholic saints was banned in Germany and England. But people had become accustomed to the annual visit from the gift-giving saint and didn't want to forget the purpose of the holiday. So in some countries, the orders of the church were defied, and the festivities of St. Nicholas's Day were merged with Christmas celebrations. Although the gift-bearer took on new, non-religious forms, the new forms always reflected the saint's generous spirit. From the story of Santa Claus, let's go to a story titled, Santa Wore Cowboy Boots. Your reader is Laura Upton.
When my son Eric was 9 years old, he taught me a lesson I will never forget. That year, my husband, Walt's job, transferred from my hometown of St. Louis, Missouri to Fort Huachua, Arizona. At first, leaving the Midwest for another part of the United States seemed like an adventure. I felt enchanted with the stately mountains, the vast desert, and the wide Arizona sky. Our children, Julie and Eric, loved being able to ride their bikes year-round and having a yard they didn't need to mow. Decorative rocks and cacti landscaped our southwestern front yard. Mostly dry dirt covered the back, except for a sprinkling of mesquite trees, which were about the size of holly bushes back home. On weekends, we explored our new surroundings. We hiked the Coronado Mountains and visited the historic towns of Tucson, Tombstone, and Bisbee. On one outing, we ventured across the border to Nogales, Mexico, where we bought gifts from street vendors. In Nogales, a trio of raven-haired teenage girls dashed up to Eric and rubbed the top of his light blonde head. When I asked, "Why are you doing that?" one girl yelled, "For good luck!" over her shoulder as she ran giggling down the street. That small gesture made me realize how different our new home was from Missouri, where children with blonde hair and blue eyes were as common as dogwoods in springtime. By autumn, Wall was traveling a lot with his job. The kids busied themselves with schoolwork and their new friends, while I dealt with dust storms, scorpions, and snakes. Every day, the weather forecast sounded like a broken record. Sunny and mild, sunny and mild, sunny and mild. Back home, the red buds, sweet gums, and maples, real trees, would be crowned in their glorious fall colors. Even more than I missed the changing seasons, I missed my parents, my brothers and sisters, and the friends I'd left behind. As the days grew shorter, I began to feel lonely, isolated, and depressed. I longed for the smell of fresh-cut grass, the sight of a lightning storm rolling across the evening sky, and the sound of rain cascading down the roof. One afternoon, while Walt was at work and the kids were in school, I retrieved an umbrella on the bottom of the closet, dusted it off, and opened it up in the bathroom shower. Standing beneath the umbrella, I tried to imagine standing under a soft, gray Missouri sky in the pouring rain. It just wasn't the same. Thanksgiving Day, I hit my lowest point. During a telephone conversation with my family in Missouri, my sister Kathleen reminded me of our traditional day after Thanksgiving shopping marathon with our kids and our youngest sister, Bridget. "It won't be the same without you and the kids tomorrow at breakfast with Santa," she said. "If we get snow, it'll cut into our shopping time. Of course, you can shop all day in the great weather you have in Arizona." That night, I didn't even finish dinner and went to bed before the evening news. I couldn't bear to hear another sunny and mild weather forecast. The next morning, I decided to try and make the best of the day. I'd promised to take Eric to visit Santa and to take Julie, who at 12 no longer believed in Santa Claus, shopping for Christmas gifts. I thought if we stuck to at least one of our holiday traditions, we might feel more of the Christmas spirit. But instead of things being better, they were worse. At the breakfast table, Julie and Eric argued over whose turn it was to read the cereal box, who was supposed to feed the dog, and who got to ride in the front seat when we went shopping. "You're both sitting in the back," I said. "And if you don't stop arguing, we'll stay home." My threat seemed to work. The kids quieted down. But by the time we'd put on our shorts and t-shirts and hopped into the car, I was in a crabby mood again. I turned up the radio as we drove to town so I wouldn't have to listen to the kids bicker over whose fault it was that I was so angry. I just didn't have the energy to turn the car around and spend the day inside. When we got to the department store, Julie hurried off to the music department while Eric and I stood in the line behind the velvet ropes and the fake snow of the North Pole. At the front of the line, I stared in disbelief at the store's version of Santa. Instead of having jolly red cheeks and a snow-white beard, he had a deeply lined, suntanned face. His beard was scraggly and gray. Silver and turquoise rings adorned his nicotine-stained fingers. I looked down at his feet and shook my head. Instead of shiny, solid black boots, this southwestern Santa wore pointed-toe snakeskin cowboy boots. The only thing missing were spurs and a 10-gallon hat. I sighed and mumbled, "I don't believe it. Can't these people get anything right?" "What's wrong, Mom?" Eric asked. "Nothing," I sighed and nudged him forward. "Go on, you're next."
"Well now, little partner," Santa said, putting his arm around Eric. "Have you been behaving yourself and listening to your mom and dad?"
Eric glanced at me and then nodded.
"Is that right, Mom?"
Santa asked, looking in my direction. "Most of the time," I said. "He's usually well-behaved." My son stood taller after hearing the compliment.
"And what is it that you want Santa to bring you, little partner?"
Eric's face lit up as he recited the list of presents he hoped to receive under the Christmas tree. He finished with a skateboard and a new bike. Santa asked,
"Anything else?"
Eric stared at his feet. "For my mom not to be so sad all the time." My face grew red as Santa's suit and my heart sank when I heard my son's words.
Until then, I hadn't realized how much homesickness had been affecting him. Peering over his wire-rimmed glasses, Santa said, "How about it, Mom? Can you give our little partner here a smile every once in a while?" Blinking back tears, I nodded. Santa handed Eric two candy canes and said, "Here's one for you and one for your mom." After we left the toy department to find Julie, I gave Eric a big hug. "I'm so sorry," I said, wiping my eyes. When Julie saw us, she said, "What's wrong, Mom? What did he do now?" "Nothing," I said. "It's what I've done. But things are going to change starting today. How would you guys like to go home and make Christmas cookies?" "Cool!" We stopped at the grocery store and filled our cart with chocolate chips, nuts, coconut, and other sweet ingredients. On the way home, I rolled down the windows, turned off the radio, and the three of us sang Christmas carols. When a roadrunner darted in front of the car, we all laughed out loud, something we hadn't done in a long time. I realized as we drove past the mountains and under a canopy of clear blue sky that although each place has its own special beauty, there's nothing as beautiful as the laughter of a child. That day, my son taught me that Christmas isn't about snowflakes or evergreen trees or holly bushes or jolly-faced Santas in red suits and black boots. It's about embracing the blessings in your life and sharing them with those you love.
The legend of hanging Christmas stockings may be most familiar in the words of a line from Clement Clark Moore's classic Christmas poem. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. But hanging stockings is actually one of the oldest Christmas traditions, even though this tradition originated not as a part of the celebration of Christ's birth, but rather as a tribute to a priest. Christmas stockings today are often quite large, usually have names written on them, and are rarely a piece of clothing that can be worn in public. The modern Christmas stocking is often just another ornament, something to hang from the mantle or wall, simply because it has always been done that way. In the 21st century, the grand presents that most children wish for at Christmas could scarcely be held in a simple sock, and most kids would be dismayed if all they could claim on Christmas morning fit into the old stocking hung by the fireplace. Yet in ancient times, particularly in Eastern Europe, the stocking hanging by the fire was an essential part of each child's December dreams. During the 4th century, a priest named Nicholas ministered to the poor families throughout his hometown of Patara and the area around Bari and what is now Turkey. The son of rich parents, this remarkable man who would become an archbishop while still in his 20s, felt a particular calling to reach out to the poor. Be it through gifts or kind words, he was constantly finding ways to make the lives of children better. During this time, Nicholas heard about a widower and his three teenage daughters who lived in the town where Nicholas was staying. The impoverished man and his family were literally starving to death. Things had gotten so bad that the father was even considering selling a daughter into slavery. He reasoned that if he sold one child, he might be able to raise enough money to have dowries for the other two. With the dowries, the girls could be married and escape the poverty and hunger that was characteristic of their daily lives. As was their custom each evening, the girls each washed their one pair of stockings and hung them by the fire to dry overnight. Then they went to bed. The father turned in soon thereafter. Sometime after midnight, someone silently opened a window and tossed a gold piece into one of the stockings. The oldest daughter discovered the coin the next day as she dressed. She took it to her father, who looked to heaven and thanked God for the miracle. That first gold coin became the oldest daughter's dowry. After she was married, a coin astonishingly appeared in the second daughter's stockings. The remarkable event was repeated again for the youngest child as well. Naturally, the news of the magical appearance of the money in the stockings quickly became known throughout the community. Most believed it to be a gift straight from heaven, but a few noted that the priest Nicholas had been in town each time money was found. They also pointed to the generosity of the clergyman as proof that he was the real source of the gifts that kept the family together. Either way, many others wanted to become a part of this magical experience. Throughout the land, men, women, and children began to search their stockings each morning for gifts. They looked especially hard whenever Nicholas happened to be visiting their village. Initially, during the first 100 years after Moore wrote the poem we now know as The Night Before Christmas, Santa deposited almost all of the presents into stockings. Soon children sensed that the size of their foot determined the generosity of the old man from the North Pole, and began to hang larger and larger socks by the fireplace. With the invention of electricity and the toy trains that followed, a child's Christmas dreams could no longer be held by a simple sock. But the stockings were still hung each year, even though Santa often no longer filled them. Today, when the stockings are filled, it is often with candy or money instead of gifts. Some people still cling to the old tradition of placing an orange in the stocking. The orange symbolizes the gold of Nicholas's gift to the poor father and his three daughters. While the stockings hung each year are rarely ones that are worn, and while these Christmas decorations are most often bought, not homemade, what they stand for should be as treasured in a modern Christmas as it was by the poor widower and his daughters more than 1,600 years ago. From one piece of clothing to another, let's listen to Jim Seitz read Lessons from an Ugly Shirt.
As clothes went, it was kind of ugly. A blue denim western cut shirt with purple pearl buttons. Polite people would stop at calling it gaudy. But to a couple of new high school graduates testing their first semester in college, it was the height of comfort and style. The epitome of cool in a jeans and t-shirt world. The shirt belonged to my college roommate, David. And because I gave him free use of my stereo, he let me wear the shirt, sometimes, when he wasn't wearing it. And since we knew the shirt had the power to drive college women wild, note, we were a couple of hormone-crazed college guys who talked a better game than we actually played, it was hard to turn such power over to anyone else, even to the guy who owned it. But we shared the shirt. And as the semester progressed, we shared our stories. David was in school by virtue of scholarships and grants. He was smart. That was obvious from our first meeting. He liked great music, Charlie Daniels and Asleep at the Wheel, good movies, Smokey and the Bandit, great literature, Harlan Ellison and Doc Savage pulp novels, and he knew the plot to every Bugs Bunny cartoon ever made. He also understood things like calculus and geometry, and could read French when the occasion presented itself. He worked hard to keep his scholarships, because without even one of them, he would be out of school and back on the farm. He always felt one transcript away from having to go home. And in David's home, there was always just enough money to make ends meet. His father died when he was 12, and his mother worked as a nurse. She made enough to keep the family farm running, but there were few extras. Sometimes David talked about his father, about his kind ways and his easy laugh. Usually it was late at night, on the way back from a meal at my folks' house, or in the dorm just before bed. And the conversation always ended with tears that flowed from a river of memories and longings. Memories of a father ravaged by cancer, at a time when his son was just coming into his own. Longings for opportunities missed, because disease does not understand about the bond between father and son, nor does it care. On the day before he left for college, his mother took him to his favorite restaurant for pizza and then gave him a beautiful gift, a wonderfully extravagant gift. Some would call it ugly. More polite folks would stop with gaudy. But a good mother knows true style when she sees it. And a good mother knows that some gifts speak volumes. Even a blue denim, western cut shirt with purple pearl buttons. It was his graduation gift, late. And certainly not in the family budget. But what does love care? 2 days later, David and his gaudy shirt walked into what would become our world for the next year. As that first semester wound down, all thoughts turned to exams and to going home for Christmas, especially going home for Christmas. Exams were just the necessary hurdle everybody had to jump over before the trip home. On that particular Christmas, we set about planning what would be known as the Thomas and Dave Christmas Invitational Christmas Party. Granted, we invited only Rick from the next room over, but every party has to have a theme. Knowing David's financial situation, Rick and I handled the entertainment and the refreshments while David took care of the decorating. The party was a great success. We watched Frosty the Snowman on a small black and white portable television, basking in the glow of our cedar tree trimmed with pull tabs from a semester's worth of Pepsi and Mountain Dew cans, a few ornaments from home, and a box of tinsel. And then we had a real feast. Potato chips, chocolate chip cookies, bean dip, little smoked sausages, pickles, and Little Debbie Christmas tree cakes. Makes your mouth water just thinking about it. David even wrapped a few boxes with paper from the art department and put them under the tree for effect. We ate, Frosty came to life, Rudolph saved Christmas, and all was right with the world. Except for the bean dip part. Bad idea. When the party ended, we all said our goodnights, headed to our respective beds, and dreamed of home. The next morning, Rick dropped in to say goodbye and David presented him with a small package. To many people, it would have looked like a regular old paperback science fiction novel. But to a science fiction fan who knew something of David's limited resources, it was a true gift indeed. After much hugging, back slapping, and words of thanks, Rick headed home, and David and I resumed loading our cars. It was on my last trip upstairs to our dorm room that I saw the package on my bed. I was standing there looking at it when David walked in. "What is that?" He asked the question and sat on the edge of his bed. I told him I didn't know. I just found it there. "Well," he said, "open it up. It could be a present." "You think so?" I stripped off the wrapping paper and sat on my bed. There was a Christmas card in the box and a handwritten note. "Thomas, I can't begin to thank you enough for your friendship. This has been a tough semester, and you have been more than a friend. Thank you for listening. Thank you for everything. Merry Christmas, David." I pushed aside the tissue paper in the box and started to cry. My tears fell on a blue denim, western-cut shirt with purple pearl buttons, the one his mother gave him. I still have it. It has faded with age, and the wrinkles have become a permanent part of the fabric. And I pray the lesson it taught has become a permanent part of my fabric.
It might seem strange to many people that each Christmas season, mistletoe, a parasitic plant, has the unique, mischievous, and delightful role of holiday matchmaker. Yet a stolen kiss on a cold moonlit evening is only one of many reasons that for centuries this waxy green leaf plant has been tacked over doorways all around the world during the month of September. The plant received its name from 2nd century Anglo-Saxons. In Old English, mistel is the word for dung, and tan means twig. Mistletan is the Old English version of the word we now know today as mistletoe. The name implies that the plant sprang to life from bird droppings on tree branches. The inspiration behind the plant's christening, though true, might seem a bit crude and distasteful today. But to the people of the 1st and 2nd century, it was a radiant sign of God's power to bring life from death, to create something beautiful and robust from something ugly and useless. Scandinavian warriors would stop fierce battles if they or the opposing soldiers suddenly found themselves under trees where mistletoe grew. They believed that to continue a war beneath the plant that God had given the world as a sign of life would dishonor him. A host of other societies soon adopted this rule as well. For millions of people, mistletoe became not just a symbol of peace, but a sign that demanded peace. A Norse legend held that mistletoe shaped into an arrow was the most powerful force in the world, and could instantly bring down the mightiest warrior. The only way this fallen soldier could be saved was if a loved one used mistletoe berries to restore his life. As this legend of the restorative power of mistletoe berries migrated to England, the plant became a symbol of love. When a couple passed under the plant, they had to stop and kiss. If they did, God would bless them with everlasting love. Still, to make sure that this custom was not abused, the boy had to pick one berry for each kiss. When the berries were gone, the kissing was supposed to end. Today, the mistletoe's Christian message of peace, faith, and hope has been largely lost. But even if in a rather childish fashion, the message of love has remained. That is why mistletoe is mentioned in countless Christmas songs, movies, and TV shows. The green and red plant can be seen topping silly hats and decorating all kinds of clothing. It can also be found hanging over millions of doors. From the magic of the mistletoe, let's move to a story titled Simply Magic. Your reader is Michelle Teske.
It's dark. The black sky sparkles with the brilliant light of distant stars. It's cold. And the laughter and chatter of excited anticipation makes puffs of smoke with every joyful breath. Everyone is happy. Mom, Dad, and all five kids, ages 11 months to 7 years. We've just come from Christmas Eve Mass and look forward to a delicious dinner. Okay, it's really McDonald's, but the drive-thru isn't too crowded and the servers actually get our order right. We sit down to our meal. Carols play softly. The Christmas tree glows. Fries by candlelight. The evening flies. It's nearly bedtime. Mom, the cookies! Our daughter's voice conveys an urgency suggesting Santa's imminent starvation should we fail to supply the cookies. I open the Tupperware and she carefully arranges cookies on a decorative paper plate. Her fastidious attention to the plate's palette of color, shape, and flavor create a delicious opportunity for the baby. While our culinary artist considers how an additional chocolate chip or sugar sprinkle cookie will affect the composition of Santa's snack, our sly baby makes his move. His tiny, chubby fingers cling to the table's edge. Stealthily, he pulls himself up. In the twitch of a reindeer nose, the baby grabs a cookie, drops to his bottom, and crawls away with cheetah-like speed. Mom! Shrieks our little girl. I scoop up the baby as he gums his sugary catch. Don't worry, I'll put him to bed. I take him and his 2-year-old brother up the stairs. Neither really protest. They're tired after a busy day of play. As our daughter finishes her cookie masterpiece, our middle son, who has trouble with certain consonants, studies it critically. What if Hanta gets husty? He asked. Our oldest considers the problem and then searches for pencil and paper. He touches the eraser to his lips, leans toward the paper, and with purposeful determination begins, Dear Santa, he prints carefully, forming each letter to his second grade teacher's exact specifications. What are you writing? His ever curious sister asks. Shh, I have to concentrate. He continues, The milk is in the... Panic strikes. Dad, how do you spell fridge? My husband pauses as he sweeps French fries. R-E... How can fridge start with an R? Our phonetically aware daughter interrupts. Fridge. F-R-I-G. F-R-I-G. I think it's an F. Well, it's really called a refrigerator, my husband says as he sweeps up a fry mixed mysteriously with pine needles. Refrigerator. Refrigerator, repeats our little girl. Our son's pencil hits the table with impatience. How do you spell it? R, says our girl. E? No, protests our insulted second grader. Dad, I was only trying to help, pouts our wounded first grader. My husband begins, R-E, got that? F-R-I-D, he dumps the dustpan of fries. G-E-R-A-T-O-R, got it. Our writer thinks, then adds, thank you for coming. Everyone present signs the note after the word love. My husband forges the baby's names. I come down the steps and announce bedtime. They're willing tonight, even eager, but first they want to check Santa's progress one last time. We log onto the internet and go to NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command. From its North Canadian post, this government organization tracks Santa's sleigh and reindeer as they depart the North Pole and travel around the world. We reach the site and an up-to-minute report begins. An official voice announces that right now Santa is leaving Rio de Janeiro. We watch the video showing his sleigh flying gracefully around the Christ the Redeemer monument and heading toward the United States. NORAD projects that Santa's arrival time in our hometown will be around midnight. He's coming! They cheer. Come on, it's time for bed, I say. There's no argument tonight. They all run up the stairs. I follow slowly to make sure they brush their teeth and say their prayers. They know they must go to sleep. Santa won't come until they're asleep. But it's hard to sleep. It's impossible to sleep. It's all too wonderful. Tomorrow's Christmas. Tomorrow! A glance out the window. Then a long stare. The flashing red light on the radio tower, it's... Could it be? I want to believe it too. But if it is Rudolph, they must go to sleep. Now. Santa's coming. A mad dash of little sock feet and quick leaps into bed. Covers pulled warmly around them in a moment of silence. Suddenly, quiet. Then a little voice asks, Do you hear Santa yet?
Shh. I think I hear him.
Shh. Giggles and laughter and quiet whispers and whispers that get louder and then shh. Again and again, but finally the shh lasts. It's quiet and it stays quiet. Sleep. And then a sound. It's late or early, the middle of the night. I'm awakened and I make the mom rounds checking on the kids. The babies are sleeping soundly, curled up in their cribs, their little bottoms skyward. My next little guy is oddly arranged with most of his body avoiding the soft mattress, seeking the hard plastic of his race car bed. I pull the blanket around my daughter on the bottom bunk, and as I look toward the top one, my oldest pops his head out.
Did you hear that, Mom? You have to go to sleep. I think it was Santa. Go to sleep. I love you. Can we check, Mom?
Check? His sparkling eyes and innocent belief win my heart. What's a few more lost moments of sleep? In just one or maybe two more years, a rooftop noise on Christmas Eve might make him merely roll over. For the moment, whatever woke us holds the promise of childhood magic.
Okay, but we won't go down. We'll only peek from the steps.
He springs from his bed, not a bit tired.
Shh, I say.
Oh, okay. And he begins an exaggerated tiptoe out the door and into the hall. I take his hand as we creep down the steps. My own heart pounds with excitement. One, two, three. From about the sixth step, we can see. Just a night light burns. The tree is not lit. The room is mostly dark, but somehow the shadows shine. I watch my little boy, his eyes wide, his smile broad. He glows with awe and happiness.
All those presents. Look, look at the stockings. Mommy, Mom, he ate the cookies. He ate the cookies.
Shh. But I'm even happier. We hug with happiness. We sit on the steps and linger in this wonderful night. But it's late or very early, and we must get some sleep. My little boy hurries to bed. I fix his blanket and kiss his cheek. He falls asleep immediately. I lie awake. My dreams are visions of joy. Tomorrow is Christmas, but there will be no better present than tonight.
Terry Keenan joins us now with her story of Toy Soldiers.
The rides to Pennsylvania were filled with anticipation. I preferred the train to driving. Something about the trains charmed me. I waited anxiously for the train to pull in, eager to see my new baby cousin, representative of siblings I wished to have and didn't. The downside to the trip was that my mother and grandparents always stayed at a motel, and I slept at my aunt and uncle's. Though I hated sleeping away from home, they were loving to me, and their apartment was cheerful enough by day, filled with bright sunlight and a balcony overlooking a grassy knoll. But nights in the country were dark and scary, and there was an intangible chill that frightened me. I was a city girl, used to city lights. When I visited, which I did nearly every Christmas and on summer vacations and other special occasions, I of course had to follow their rules. Also, there was a man in the house, my uncle. I wasn't used to having a man in the house or even other children. I was accustomed to living alone with my mother since her divorce from my father. Worse, at my aunt's house, I was the oldest child. I was expected to know better and to do right. Only I didn't know better, and I seldom seemed to do right. In my house, I was an only child. I was treasured and pampered by my mother and a loving pair of grandparents. At my aunt's, I was just one of three and the big girl, so I was embarrassed to tell her how afraid and lonely I was at night. My aunt was waiting at the train station when we arrived. I was so excited to see my little cousin, but when we walked through the door of their home, my aunt announced that she had found a perfect playmate for me, a boy who had just moved into the apartment next door. A boy, that meant trouble. Boys were the ones who teased you at school, pulled your hair, and called you dirty names you didn't understand and your mother wouldn't explain to you. They carried out their threats to punch you in the stomach so hard you gasped for air. At 5 and a half, I learned that it was best to stay away from boys, and I sure didn't want one for a friend. Despite my earnest protests, my aunt went next door and fetched Freddie. He was a little younger than I, having just turned 5, but he was much taller. He came in and we were introduced. Neither of us spoke. I knew I was safe as long as the adults were around, but I didn't relish being alone with him. So when he asked me to come over to see his toy soldiers, because, he said, looking askance at my doll collection, there isn't anything good to play with here. I hesitated. Go, my aunt said. Go, you're a big girl. There it was again. It's only across the hall. I hated to feel stupid, so I went. And there they were. 200 toy soldiers lined up for battle. Colonels, commanders, lieutenants, officers, privates, and sergeants ready for action, waiting for Freddy. They all wore green, all 200 of them. In fact, everything was army green, right down to the tanks and jeeps. Freddy fell to the floor. Bang, bang, he shouted. Look out, men, the enemy. Vroom, vroom, the jeep rode along. Bang, bang, duck, open fire, charge. I was transfixed. Freddy looked up at me. Well, what are you waiting for? Come on, let's play. He actually wanted me to play. I dove down, but I didn't know what to do. I was used to dressing and holding my baby dolls. I tentatively picked up a soldier and made a feeble attempt at bang, bang. No, Freddy said, looking genuinely appalled. You just shot one of our men. The enemies are over there, he pointed. They all look the same, I offered. Girls, he muttered. On the other side of this line over there, he said, pointing again. Those are the enemy. Then he did the oddest thing. He took my hand and placed it in his over the soldier. Now say bang, bang, he said. Bang, bang. Great, he said. Now try it alone. We played for hours. It wasn't like playing with dolls, but Freddy made it fun. So much so that I could hardly wait till morning when Freddy planned to come back for a visit. The next day, I tried out my cousin's bow and magnetic arrows, missing the target every time. Freddy walked over and put his arms around me. Like this, he said, guiding my hand gently and patiently. I drew my arm back and got a bullseye. Freddy's eyes lit up. I remember it as though it were yesterday. Yes, great, he said, genuinely happy for me. Half of me was beginning to trust this male creature. The other half was waiting for him to start teasing or punching me. But it never happened. I had never felt the way I felt when Freddy placed his arms around me. It was a new feeling, a funny feeling, a very soft and close feeling. This from a boy person. I felt for the first time in my life like a girl, a real girl. Subsequent visits to my aunt and uncle's house became less and less gloomy sounding, and the nights, once scary, were now filled with anticipation of the next day's bringing Freddy and his ever-ready toy soldiers. Freddy and his platoon seemed to be glued together. If Freddy came over, so too did the soldiers. If I went to Freddy's, the men in green stood ready and waiting. I learned something by playing with Freddy. I learned to put my dolls aside and to play with soldiers, even if it wasn't as much fun, because Freddy liked it. And he learned too, I think, that playing father to my dolls wasn't the end of the world. In fact, sometimes I think he almost liked it. I didn't know firsthand about romance, but I had seen many movies, and Freddy and I began to kiss goodnight, first on the cheek, then once behind closed doors on the lips. I felt pretty for the first time in my life. My family and other adults used to say how pretty I was, but the boys in school made me feel like I had the bubonic plague or something. With Freddy, well, I felt just maybe that I wasn't half bad after all. We visited Pennsylvania again for Christmas. I got the doll I wanted from my mother and a real pearl necklace from my aunt. By now, Freddie and I had known each other about a year and a half. On this visit, we stayed for several days, so I had plenty of time to be with Freddie. When the last day of vacation came, I felt sad. It had been a wonderful holiday, and I dreaded going back to school. My aunt, grandmother, and mother went out shopping. Freddie came over shortly after they left. He was carrying a large, crumpled brown paper bag. Freddy held out both arms and pushed the bag into my hands. What's this? I asked. Open it, he said. Merry Christmas. I looked in the bag and then up at Freddy. In the bag were Freddy's toy soldiers. What? I said. It's for you, he said. But they're yours, I said, astonished. No, I want you to have them, he said, and he ran out of the door, slamming it behind him, not staying to play. I just looked at the door, not understanding why Freddy didn't stay to play. Finally, I sat down on the floor and poured out the contents of the bag. Then I counted. 200. All 200. Tanks, jeeps, guns, soldiers, everything. I put each soldier in place, lining them up as Freddy had taught me to do. I organized them into the good guys and the bad guys. I put the kneeling men with their guns on the front line. Then I began. Bang, bang, vroom, vroom, chicka, chicka, chicka. But it was no use. They just didn't come to life without Freddy. I sat for the longest time, just staring at the soldiers, missing Freddy. When my mother returned, she glanced at the soldiers all neatly lined up on the floor and asked, "Where's Freddy?" The natural question. "I know he must be nearby," she smiled and pointed. "The soldiers." After all, Freddy and his soldiers were one. "He's not here," I said. She looked at me puzzled. "Freddy gave me all his soldiers. He wants me to have them." My mother gasped. I remember that. She gasped. "You can't take them," she said. "Freddy loves those soldiers. You have to give them back." I knew she was right. They were Freddy's. But something in me wanted to hold on to them. My mother must have sensed that in my expression. "I have an idea," she said. "Give Freddy his soldiers, but you keep one." She waited. Of course, it was the most brilliant idea I had ever heard. I could keep one. "Okay," I said, flooded with relief, as I suspect my mother was also. "I'll go over and speak to Freddy's mother," she said. I was further relieved that I wasn't alone in this now. My mother returned after about 10 minutes. "I'm going to tell you something," she said, "but you must promise not to tell Freddy." I nodded. I loved it when my mother confided in me. "Freddy has been crying for hours," she said. "He misses his soldiers, but he told his mother he wouldn't ask for them back. He wants you to have them." My heart sunk. I felt so awful that I hurt inside. I had made Freddy, my best friend Freddy, cry. "You've got to give the soldiers back to Freddy. Tell him you love them and you want them more than anything, but you want him to have them." I put the soldiers back into the crumpled brown bag, one by one, careful not to damage any of his treasure. I took my mother's hand and the bag, and we went over and rang Freddy's bell. Freddy's mother answered and called for Freddy. He came to the door, his eyes red and puffy from crying. I said nothing. Then, "Freddy, I can't keep these. I love them more than anything, but you love them more and they're yours." Freddy didn't look happy. Rather, he looked crestfallen. Then I understood. "But I'd like to keep one. This one," I said as I reached into my pocket and pulled out a soldier. "Meet Sergeant Freddy." Freddy's face lit up. "Can I keep him?" I asked tentatively. Freddy nodded enthusiastically. "That's a great idea," he said, reaching out and accepting the brown bag from me. Then he poured out 199 soldiers and began to set them up. "Can she stay a while?" he looked up at my mother. "For a few minutes," my mother answered, smiling. "We have to catch the 6 o'clock train." I dropped down on the floor and began playing, watching Freddy bring the soldiers back to life again. It was magic. On the train ride home, my mother and I sat together behind my grandparents. We were both very quiet. "Do you have the soldier?" my mother asked. "You mean Sergeant Freddy," I corrected and pulled him out of my pocket. "See, he's right here. I'm taking Freddy back to New York and I'm going to keep him by my bed. I'm going to keep him forever, Mommy, forever." My mother touched my face gently. There were tears in her eyes. At the time, I didn't understand why, because I felt good inside. Very, very good.
Even in forums that ignore Jesus' tie to the Christmas holiday, angels often find a prominent place. For reasons few can explain, throughout history, these heavenly creatures have touched hearts and changed minds. They have caused people to reflect and reconsider. And they have represented the force of good in such profound ways that even evil seems to bow down before them. And while it is written that they are with us always, perhaps it is during Christmas that they seem most real to us. They can be found in music, in television shows, and in all kinds of advertisements. Angels are the stars of movies, the subjects of books, and the fundraising symbols of numerous organizations. The dictionary defines an angel as a divine winged messenger. While accurate, this definition fails to touch on the warm and personal relationship that angels have traditionally had with humankind. Throughout history, angels have been protectors as well as messengers. An angel is represented in this next story with Miracle in Georgetown. Your reader is Jim Seitz.
He staggered in 15 minutes after the traditional holiday hymn sing had begun, plopping with a thud onto the wooden pew directly behind me. It was Christmas Eve night at historic St. Paul's Episcopal Church in the small and quaint town of Georgetown, Delaware, and midnight mass was scheduled to commence in about 20 minutes. Dozens of candles cast a warm glow throughout the church. Accompanied by the pipe organist, the congregation joined the choir in a unified voice of celebration and joy. I remember smelling the strong odor of alcohol right behind me. Trying to appear inconspicuous, I nonchalantly turned at an angle while I continued singing so I could glance at the whiskey-breathed intruder. A young man, perhaps age 25, maybe younger, sat alone in the pew, a drunken smile plastered across his unshaven face. His hair was bushy and uncombed, his clothing unbefitting a reverent church service. I did not recognize the fellow and later would learn that nobody else knew him either, which is odd in Georgetown, a friendly place where everyone seems to know everybody else and their family trees. I immediately realized that the man was confused, and not just with the Christmas Eve service, which for a first-time visitor can be somewhat perplexing. He was disoriented in general. He stumbled aimlessly through the hymnal and a prayer book, like a child leafing through coloring books at the doctor's office. He was obviously intoxicated, and his behavior made me uncomfortable. Judging by the numerous nervous stares I observed, targeted in the young man's direction, some subtle and some not so subtle, others shared my opinion. A good-natured parishioner named Bob left his family and his regularly appointed pew and joined the fellow, shaking his hand and introducing himself with a warm smile. Bob helped the man throughout the remainder of the hymn sing, assisting the delighted guy with locating the proper songs and directing him with basic liturgical functions, such as when to stand, sit, and kneel. With each song, the drunken stranger sang zealously louder and genuinely off-key. Although I suspect he felt he was singing as well as Pavarotti, I found his butchering of the traditional holiday carols both disturbing and amusing at the same time. Though he couldn't sing a lick, he certainly was having fun. The hymn sing-along ended, and the service began with "O Come All Ye Faithful," as a procession of priests in robes and acolytes bearing torches entered from the back of the church. Someone in the procession waved a canister of incense around, preparing the sanctuary for worship and God's presence, but it made my eyes water and I sneezed. The service continued with prayer and Bible readings about the birth of the Savior, the infant Jesus. Good Samaritan Bob continued to befriend the man, who grinned with delight, and I, my heart softening, traded smiles with him. Why was I at first angry that he'd come here tonight, I thought. This is God's house, not mine, and all are welcomed in the house of the Lord. I wondered whether the young man was lonely or depressed on this holiday eve, and had first sought the comfort of liquor, drowning unknown sorrows, and had somehow journeyed by our church. Perhaps he'd heard the festive Christmas music outside the ancient brick walls. Maybe he'd seen the church aglow through the windows, holly wreaths hanging from the huge oaken doors, like one of those wonderful Thomas Kincaid landscape portraits, so inviting. Perhaps something deep within his heart had prompted him to go inside. Maybe he simply needed to be in the warm company of other human beings. I wondered who he was and where he'd come from. Did he have a family? Was he married? Did he have children? The priest moved to the pulpit to begin his Christmas homily. The father had preached for only a few minutes when he abruptly stopped his sermon. I initially thought that he'd lost his place or was pausing for oratorial effect. But then I noticed him looking upon the congregation with a concerned frown rippling across his forehead. A low, curious murmur spread throughout the congregation. Everyone, including myself, looked to where the priest was gazing. About four pews back from the front, on the left side, Bill, an elderly man who faithfully attended every Sunday, had slumped over. Several members of the congregation had moved to his aid, thinking he had merely passed out. The situation, however, was far graver. The service came to a complete halt as one parishioner sprinted to call 911. Several people laid Bill on his back in the pew and attempted to revive him. Although a medical doctor and several nurses were on hand that evening, the matter did not appear good. Bill was unconscious, had stopped breathing, and his pulse was weak. Even from across the center aisle in dim lighting, I could see his flesh turning gray. Stunned, most of us just sat or stood in our pews, paralyzed with fear and disbelief. A beloved member of our church community was dying before our eyes, and suddenly it no longer felt like Christmas Eve. I felt helpless, lost. Then a voice spoke out. "Why don't we all get down on our knees and pray for the old guy?" The voice bellowed from behind me. It was our visitor, his voice slurred but strong. "Maybe God can help him." Like a slap in the face, many of us snapped out of our panicked stupor and silently knelt in agreement with the man's suggestion. As several people continued to tend to Bill, who was near death, the rest of the congregation prayed in honest, pleading whispers. I prayed harder and more sincerely than I ever had, my eyes wet and tightly shut. Moments later, I heard a commotion to my left. I opened my eyes just as I whispered Amen and was shocked to see Bill sitting up, his eyes open, the paleness in his face rapidly disappearing. Happy sobs could be heard throughout the church. Our prayers had been gloriously answered. Despite numerous inquiries, Bill assured us that he was fine. When the paramedics arrived, racing down the center aisle with their equipment and stretcher, he refused to go to the hospital, insisting on staying for the conclusion of Christmas Eve Mass. And after everything settled down, the service was, in fact, finished without further incident. After the closing benediction and song, arousing joy to the world, I turned to shake the young man's hand, but he was gone. He had apparently left during the Eucharist as the congregation filed pew by pew for the bread and wine, the body and blood of our Savior. I later discovered that no one else had seen the man leave either. It was as if he'd appeared out of nowhere and then simply vanished into thin air. No one knew his identity or anything about him. He was no one's relative or neighbor or co-worker. No one knew or ever saw again the man who visited us that Christmas Eve when a whole church witnessed a miracle. A dying man was revived, saved from death, by prayer initiated by a stranger, a person like you or me, or perhaps the guy we pass every day in the street and pay no attention to, an unlikely angel who prays for our health and happiness, for peace and goodwill to all.
Universal acceptance of the Christmas tree as a holiday essential occurred less than two centuries ago, but the roots of bringing an evergreen into one's home during the darkest days of Christmas can be traced back more than 1,000 years. The evergreen tree, along with the Christ child and Santa Claus, has evolved into a central symbol of the world's most celebrated holiday. To Christians, the Christmas tree is often more than just another decoration. It is a vibrant part of the spiritual essence of the season as well. Even 1,000 years after the crucifixion of Christ, most of those living in what is now Scandinavia had not been reached by Christian missionaries. In the winter, with the winds howling, snow piled up as high as rooftops, and temperatures constantly hovering below zero, life was tough. Scores of villagers and animals died each year due to the effects of this dark and depressing season. Yet during the long and often brutal winter, when the sun disappeared for months and night seemed to last forever, the deeply superstitious Vikings found hope and strength in the evergreen tree. The evergreen not only survived the harsh winter, it even seemed to thrive when times were most bleak. In an effort to bring some of the magic of the evergreen tree into their lives, Vikings would chop down a fir and place it in their homes. Having a tree in the house was said to bring the gift of strength to live through the worst stretches of winter. The Vikings were not the only ones who considered the evergreen a symbol of life and good fortune. Many other people groups throughout Europe incorporated into their lives the mystery of this tree that stayed green in winter. Catherine Crosswhite joins us for our final story with Old Christmas Tree.
The first Christmas without both of my grandparents. They had lived full, rich lives into their 80s, leaving behind 5 children, 4 grandchildren, and 5 great-granddaughters. Grandpa had died first, after a brief bout with bone cancer, at home on Thanksgiving night. Several years later, congestive heart failure finally won the battle and took Grandma in her sleep one January night. It was best that Grandpa had died before his wife of more than 50 years. I don't know how he would have gotten along without her. Not that his absence hadn't been hard for her, but she'd managed. The tradition in my Slovak family is to open gifts on Christmas Eve, after enjoying a home-cooked dinner of sour soup, which only those of Slavic heritage can appreciate, and fish. With Grandmother no longer there to prepare the old-fashioned Christmas Eve meal, we debated for weeks whether to continue the tradition. But we decided it just wouldn't be Christmas Eve without our Slavic fish and sour soup. My mother and her younger sister got out their mother's handwritten recipes and gave it their best shot. After all, they had assisted her with the preparations for years. How hard could it be? My mother baked the traditional nut and poppy seed rolls, which turned out even tastier than Grandma's. And she found just the right kind of fish for the entree and mushrooms for the soup. The rest of us did what we could. Peeled and boiled potatoes, cleaned and prepared the vegetables, set the table. We even remembered my grandmother's sugared stewed prunes. 16 of us shared the new old-fashioned Christmas Eve dinner, which turned out to be almost as good as Grandma's. Everyone was glad that we had decided not to give up at least that tradition. After doing the dishes and opening the Christmas presents, the adults sat around the living room, reminiscing as families do on holidays, while the children went off to play together. My first cousin from Wisconsin and I had shared every Christmas Eve of our childhoods together, and now we had daughters close to the same age. It was fun to watch our children get to know each other. The freshly cut tree was beautifully decorated, as always, with lights and ornaments that had been around forever. It stood in a corner of the living room, where my grandparents' favorite chairs had always been, as if to fill the void of their absence. As I sat across the room, gazing at the tree, the oddest thing happened. The tree shook, gently, as if someone had reached in, grabbed it by the trunk, and given it a single shake. All heads turned at the melodious sound of the ornaments tinkling gently, sweetly, momentarily hypnotized until the ornaments settled back into place. No one spoke. Then we all spoke at once. What happened? Who did that? Where are the kids? One uncle grabbed his camera and took a picture of the tree. We did our best to explain what happened, but couldn't. It was December in Illinois. No windows were open. No door had opened or closed to cause a breeze. No one was even walking around. Everyone in the room was sitting. We looked under the tree for a toddler. All the kids were in another room on the other side of the house. We jumped on the floor. The tree didn't move. The house has a concrete floor. Nothing moved. Needless to say, there was only one topic of conversation the rest of the evening. A few weeks later, my uncle brought his pictures around. On the photo he'd taken of the shaking tree was a pair of round, hazy, but obvious gray spots. Lens glare? Maybe. Spirits of Christmas past? We'll never know. Film is sensitive. There could be a technical explanation. Then again, maybe not. We still discuss this event at family gatherings, especially at Christmas, when we all sit around looking at the tree and hoping, I think, that it will move again. But it never has, and we've never found a physical explanation for the tree shaking. What we do know for sure is that we all had the same feeling when it happened, that Grandma and Grandpa had found a way to tell us they were together again, and happy that we had carried on our family Christmas tradition.
We hope you enjoyed the 2008 Turning Sight Into Sound Christmas Special. The stories were selected from a book titled A Cup of Comfort for Christmas, stories that celebrate the warmth, joy, and wonder of the holiday. I'd like to take the time to thank the volunteers to be a part of this Christmas special. I've been your host, Jim Martinez, and on behalf of everyone here at Taping for the Blind, Merry Christmas.